Okay, so thinking with the head, I want to start out by dwelling on the first phrase of the title of this presentation, Thinking with the Head, by which I hope to draw attention to the notorious head reading or head measuring practices of the racist science of craniology in the 19th century. But more than yet another critical take on these head reading practices, what I want to pursue here and is signalled by the emphasis on the with in the title phrase is an account in which the head is a central character. As co-author Colin Perrin and I say in a forthcoming piece for the Journal of Cultural Economy, the head was not just a prop, but a player in the complex set of practices by which the idea of racial difference became fixed as innately given in the 19th century, in 19th century science and popular thought. Now, obviously, through the course of the next 50 or so minutes, I'm going to touch on aspects of that that drama. But first, just to do some framing up. So a seminar, then, in over many parts, six parts, which then brings me to the second phase, phrase in today's title for a secular ethics of race and the human. Now, critical attention to what is called human exceptionalism, that is, the idea that the human is endowed with a unique and privileged status among other beings, has gathered considerable pace in recent years, and I think this is especially evident among perhaps all of the cultural and social and human sciences, in human geography, as well as also more popularly. The narrative attempt to decenter the human certainly has a growing constituency in Australia, where there are subfields now of nature culture studies and also the eco-humanities provide a welcome innovation. Pursuing a new ecological ethic, the attempt to decenter the human offers a basis upon which the legacy of an ontological separation between people and the non-human environment, which is a separation acutely felt in a settler colony like Australia, this new ecological ethic, I think, provides a basis upon which to rethink and challenge and to decenter the human. This paper, or at least what I'm going to try to do today, sketch out a project that's very much in process, contributes to this task of decentering the human. But departing from the prevalent concern in the nature culture intervention so far in geography with the role and with the status of non-human things and with more than human entities, that has been the driving preoccupation of that intervention. What I want to stay with in this project is in fact the figure of the human. And here I wanted to do that in an attempt to elicit its fundamentally unstable and its precarious character. Substantively, my way into this topic has grown out of this book, Race and the Crisis of Humanism. What it seeks to try to do is to establish a historical connection between ontologies of human distinction and race. Now, conventionally, race has been considered in terms that maintain a firm boundary around the human. So it's, in other words, then, it's been considered in terms that confine it to a problematic of intersubjective dynamics or what we tend to call in cultural geography identity politics. And this is, I'm sure, familiar enough stuff for people of you here in this audience, especially those with interests in post-colonial studies and interests in cultural geography more generally. In these terms, race is considered as an inferiorising mythology and a colonial ideology, as the creation, that is, of a will to power or identity that affirms itself by maintaining the deficiency of those whose appearance and or livelihood differs from its own. Race in these terms then is understood as either an inherent or, after Said and Foucault, an ideological ethnocentrism. Now initially for me, at least growing up as I did at UBC in Canada, amidst the post-structural turn in cultural geography, the problem of race was one that could be understood only in the terms in that framework of power, knowledge, discourse. Empire, I learned, holding the long arm of Michel Foucault, is always the result of specific disciplinary regimes, rhetorical ones in texts, spatial ones in territorial administration, with the exercise of power understood by an analytics then of knowledge production. In this vein then, race is an idea, it's a social, it's a political construction, with nature then aligned to the bodily, the fixed, some kind of essentialised prejudice and difference, a dirty word. Nature talk then as reactionary, the world is what people make of it. Over the last 10 years, I would say, I became progressively restless with that framework of, as it's called, critical race theory. And of course, I quite accept that it continues to be a very useful framework in geography, just as an example, for work on racial and spatial formation. But for me, interrogation of the idea of race from my positioning in Australia, and I think that that's quite relevant to this story, for me, interrogation of race out of Australia came to require a different line of investigation and a willingness to actually think right across those massive ontological distinctions of nature and society. And so I'll take you through then, in the second section of the talk then, some of this intellectual trajectory, if you'll allow me a bit of a slightly indulgent tone of tracking my own trajectory, and I'll give you a summary of that work that came out of this restlessness with critical race theory as I've just described it. So a number of years into this restlessness, I wrote this book, Race and the Crisis of Humanism, which is a book that traces historically the disturbance that was Australia, its people and place, to Enlightenment and colonial discourses of the human. It's very much a study in geography matters. It's very much a study in thinking spatially, in the phrase of this seminar series, in the sense that the book elicits the crisis that was induced in colonial encounters by a place that bore no apparent trace of what was assumed to be a shared capacity of all people everywhere to separate from nature. A capacity that, according to Enlightenment thought, might well be constrained by environmental factors like climate conditions, like soil conditions, but nonetheless, optimistically, a view that nonetheless there existed a potential for this the world over. So a potential, that is, to separate from nature. And above all, to cultivate crops, to domesticate animals, and to settle socially in communities. And I've got a few images here that try to capture then the perplexity that was the Great Southland, as it was called, for British voyagers and early colonists. Just some images quickly then. Firstly, of hunter-gatherers who roamed and camped rather than made permanent settlements. Of quite singular animals that appeared to defy domestication, like the kangaroo and the platypus, that heaven forbid couldn't even be fitted into sensibly into 18th century metropolitan classifications of mammals and reptiles that seem to be a bit of both, so that defied those classifications. And thirdly, then, an image of a land that appeared empty and awaiting improvement, and in so doing, then misrecognising all of the forms of indigenous resource management of this land. So what the book does then is to plot. It centres around this colonial disposition of confusion that the Australian state of nature presented to prevailing ideas of what it meant to be human, Christian ideas and Enlightenment ideas, and also an optimism that I was kind of hinting at before, that people everywhere shared the potential at least to transcend nature, with nature conceived in two senses. Firstly, as and is often the case still to today, conceived in two senses. Firstly, as an external, non-human world of environment out there, and secondly, as a kind of interior, internal, animal-like corporeality. What on earth, then, was to be made of the Australian? Unlike other hunter-gatherer indigenous people encountered in Africa and the Americas, they appeared not to have crops, nor herds, no flocks, no metal, and only wood weapons. And significantly here, they defied, or they seemed to be completely indifferent to a whole range of different colonial efforts to induce them into a social state of settled cultivation. So what I try to do then, as I've been, what's become almost a life's work now of trying to get to grips with this issue of race, what the book does then is to try to make shocking again the intellectual turn that took place in the effort to make sense of this Australian anomaly. Now, this turn, it's been widely noted by generations now of race historiographers, a turn, an intellectual turn that took place in the 19th century from the kind of idea I described before, that optimistic, benign, relatively benign idea of the world's human variability, to what became in the 19th century a much more pernicious idea of innate racial difference and hierarchy. A turn that did indeed, I argue in the book, it took place. That is, it happened in the wake of not some over-generalised or some aspatial colonial will to power, that is, so much has been made of that in anti-colonial discourse analysis. Instead, a turn that I argue took place out of this southern crisis of confidence that I've just been describing, that came off, of course, the backs of encounters in Africa and America. A turn to racial determinism, to innatism, that speculated something like this: if Aboriginal people don't move out of nature, then, well, perhaps they inherently can't. Or perhaps they won't ever. Theorising the rise of race in this way from the periphery, from Australia in this case, the book then tracks the increasingly deterministic character of the race idea through the 19th century, keying into, by the mid-century, 1850s, extreme arguments such as the thesis of Louis Agassiz in the United States that the world must be made up of separate creations, not only of flora and fauna, but also of people. It was a determinism that in turn proved logically unsustainable, come Darwin's claim for the species unity of all people, but which staggeringly survived and flourished in revamped form even through evolutionism. The book cuts out, perhaps to its detriment, at the end of the 19th century, but we know that racial determinism carried on through eugenics in the 20th century, notoriously so with the Nazi experiment, and also in Australia with the Stolen Generations project that has been so much on the lips of people in Australia in the last year or two. And of course, we know that the race idea continues, you know, in manifestly variable, ever depressingly forms to today. Okay, moving on then in the talk. Lying at the back of this story was and continues to be, a curiosity. And it's been a frustratingly nagging curiosity, I should say, because of the far too fundamental issues that I sense that are at stake. And also frustrating because of the need to keep using such unpopular, homogenising language like Western, like human, like our relation to nature, terms like popular thought, terms like settler, Aboriginal and so on. Nonetheless, I've not been able to set aside this curiosity, stimulated once again in the Australian context, out of that kind of clash of civilisations that I was just describing. A curiosity about the logic, the sources of our European-derived ideas of human separateness from nature, and from animals in particular. And it's been a curiosity that led me to reading post-humanist philosophies that acknowledge that the problem of distinguishing human and animal is indeed a problem. Added to that curiosity that I just described, I had this kind of faintly formulated hypothesis that our persistent settler and modern ideas of separateness from nature may have something to do, and something quite specific that I might try to determine, with what increasingly appeared to me in the close work that I was doing in race historiography, or geo-race historiography, that it might have something to do with particular ideas of mind. Now, characteristically in Western philosophy and theology, and the now numerous feminist critiques of the mind-body distinction, the idea of mind is traced back to two premises of reason dating right back to the ancients and eternal soul from biblical anthropology. Regardless of whether the attribute and agency of mind is taken to be a force for good or whether it's taken to be a force for evil, the entity of human mind itself has been taken as so obvious as to be uncontroversial. It's inscribed as a kind of black box, a sort of a metaphysics, even, that for better or worse was handed down from the ancients, prevailed through Christian enlightenment, informed industrial modernity, justified a patriarchal mastery of nature and women, surpassed the challenge of evolutionism, landed us on the moon, etc. and so forth, and evinces its impressive and destructive evidence right into the present. It's a narrative sweep of mind's irresistible passage that even Latour, to cite an influential example, invokes and opposes. For example, in Pandora's Hope, he invokes and critiques an idea of the human as what he calls a mind in a vat, leaping in the process, as he does, from Descartes to what he says is our century of the 21st. As if the 18th, and particularly for me the 19th century, had added nothing to the metaphysical idea of the human. To use his words, we have not moved an inch since Descartes. The mind is still in its vat, contemplating the world. Now, this narrative sweep of mind's passage and persistence through time is, however, to gloss over some significant discontinuities in thought. And this is where the interests of mine in race historiography come into contact then with this intellectual history. For me, especially the 19th century, when emerged, as I'm going to come to in a moment, in that very fraught science of craniology, a specific rendering of mind as an intelligence that was not metaphysical, but was measurable and was physical, material, if you like. Indeed, the 19th century obsession with the head, in which the skulls of the world's people, including the mad, so-called mad, including the so-called degenerate, including occasionally also female skulls, this obsession in the 19th century with the skulls of the world's people, those skulls were enrolled, this obsession has, as far as I can see, received surprisingly little critical attention in nature culture scholarship and feminist critiques of the mind-body binary. And where it has been considered, and it's received a lot of attention in critical race theory and scholarship, head measuring has been understood in that paradigm that I described earlier. That's a very familiar, but as I was coming to see, quite narrow problematic of identity politics in conditions of culture contact. Yet it's an obsession which I'll be attempting to suggest repays close attention. For not only does it point to a new way of theorising race as fundamentally a discourse on the human, the account that I am pursuing here, and that I've been very grateful of the opportunity of this talk to actually try to formulate what I'm trying to do here in this project, so thank you for that. What I've been trying to amplify, I think, in this account for a 21st century audience that I sense is actually increasingly open to rethinking how humanity came to be defined. What I think the account does is to amplify the very shakiness of our most cherished marker of distinction from the non-human. After all, our 21st century audience, I think, is one in which a suspicion may well be stimulated about this assertion of human distinction. It's an audience, I think, that might, whose sensibility, if you like, might be freshly aroused, if I can use that word, to the diversity of modes of being on Earth, human and non-human. But while, yes, let's be clear here, it is the case that humans as a species are, of course, unique. This is, and I quote here, no unique sort of uniqueness, as Fernando Amesta writes in his book in 2004, So You Think You're Human. The differences between our species and others is comparable, he writes, on the basis of a genetic survey, to those that separate non-human species from each other. Okay. Right, so let me move on then in the structure of the talk. As I said, to work that's very much in progress and not completed and not published. Not yet. Okay, I think I'm just going to leave that up there as a kind of backdrop to what I want to say here. Writing Race and the Crisis of Humanism, I became more interested in, as I said before, that 19th century obsession with the head and the practices of craniometry. Practices that, as much critical race scholarship has already amply demonstrated, were instrumental in fixing in science and popular thought the idea of racial difference among the world's people as innate and as given, you know, at birth. Now, ordinarily, the relative significance attributed by critical race theorists to the head is traced to the idea, fully articulated within phrenology at the end of the 18th century, that the skull housed the brain as the organ of mind. And for history of science critics Stephen Jay Gould and Nancy Steffen, and these are to cite just two of the more notable ones, the invidious privilege accorded to the head by 19th century race scientists like Cuvier and Morton, that I'll come to in a moment, the invidious privilege accorded to the head is not in itself contentious. For Steffen, head reading was an extension of the earlier focus of Christian thought on skin colour. It was symptomatic, in Stephen Jay Gould's words, his vague words, I should say, of the importance of mentality in our lives. Leaving aside the strange paradox here that the shift to fix the idea of racial difference in the human body is taken to reside in a move to invoke a notion of mind, that the Europeans had long been opposed to the human bodily being to the physicality of that human bodily being. Leaving that paradox aside, what I do with my research associate on this project, what we do here is take this moment of the late 18th and 19th century as a chance to engage a time period that, as I said earlier, is regularly glossed over when it comes to that massive subject of human being. Yet I think it's a really quite important time period, because it was when Christian and Enlightenment assumptions about the distinctiveness of the human, typically identified with the soul or the mind, were being not affirmed at all. They were actually being challenged, as they were too differently again by Darwin in the mid-late 19th century. Scientists, after Linnaeus's 18th century classification of people as part of nature, were contending that the human could be understood as a purely physical rather than metaphysical being. Especially George Cuvier in his Lessons in Comparative Anatomy that was published in 1802. A materialist, Science of Man, as it was called, was arguing that the human was just one living being among others and ought to be the focus of a purely empirical scientific inquiry. Specifying the character of the human in physical rather than metaphysical terms then became a major scientific project, with efforts to assess and to compare the anatomies of people and animals, especially apes, and also, anticipating the next section of this talk, and also to attempts to measure mind, that is, to specify mind as a material entity, or, to word that differently again, to try to render reason itself in anatomical, physical terms. Yet, as I'll come to in a moment, despite this avowed effort to demonstrate the objective existence of mind as a material form, rather than, as in Christian thought, as a metaphysical kind of presence, the idea of mind as intelligence that got formulated in craniology did not shed its Christian origins, which is to say that it remained insufficiently secular. And here I take insufficiently secular in the very useful sense of Latour in his recent argument in Eco-Theology that he's published in the Royal Institute of Anthropology, that journal, to note that human being was still presumed, even in such materialist efforts, to be adorned, in Latour's words, with a certain supplement of the soul. So to quickly anticipate and summarise the point here about the compromise that I see was at stake, we can take the French anatomist Cuvier, for example. He was an ardent empiricist, and he compared the anatomy of different animals, and also people and animals, and he was especially interested in comparing their nervous systems. And he was determined to explain the difference between human and animal, not in abstract terms of some vague notion of soul or reason, but, as we shall see, using a very concrete tool. This was the facial angle that linked intelligence, in his word, to head size and head shape. And here then, so the argument here goes for me, never escaping and instead falling back via race on a vague metaphysical assertion of human distinction. As, to put things succinctly, it was racial skulls that he enrolled in order to try and demonstrate the real existence of the mind by correlating the known levels of development of various people with variations in the size and shape of their skulls. Okay. So I'm going to move on then to the next section of this talk, where I'm going to spend some time on the methodological approach of assemblage in this project, bound as the method is, I think, to the very conception of this project. Despite the explicit intention of Foucault's genealogical method to demonstrate the contingency of the present, so in other words then, the fact that the present could be otherwise, Foucault's genealogies have often produced the opposite result, entrenching the present in a seemingly irrevocable historical trajectory. Whether, as Latour has contended, this is due to the fact that Foucault has been widely misread in the Anglophone world, or whether it's because Foucault himself can be said to have been insufficiently attentive to the fragility of the discourses he addressed, it's clear that in actor network and assemblage theory, what's so central is the very precariousness as well as the materiality of discourse. So this project then that I'm talking about here does not take the apparent endurance over many centuries of a discourse of human distinction from nature to suppose that it too can be considered as a kind of immaterial prime mover or hidden hand that Latour, in Reassembling the Social, identifies as the error of social constructivism. Here, if we take a social constructivist position, head measuring is no more than the mere vehicle for a thesis of human exception. It's no more the mere vehicle for that thesis of human distinction than it is for racism. But this won't do, because the various practices of craniometry are the ingredients. They're not just or simply the instruments of an idea. They're the ingredients of an idea which doesn't guarantee its own articulation, but instead gets to be produced in the very act of being articulated. It is then not simply the persistence, but the singular inventions of human exceptionalism that this project takes up, documenting their precariousness, but also their materiality. So I found it a useful approach in this project because I think it helps clarify the sense in which craniometry didn't just carry a racism that turned into a racist tool, as has been so often argued by critical race theorists, but did in itself invent something. In this case, I'm arguing that it invented a specific materialist thesis of human distinction from the non-human. Now, such a history of cranial science, then, is not, therefore, just the history of an idea. It's certainly the history of numerous publications, lectures, debates, demonstrations. It's also the history of the introduction and revision, the rejection of a whole series of rationalities for cranial science. This science as well too, and here I'm staying again with the method of the project, is also the history of specific cranial measures, and I'll come to some of those in a minute, like the cephalic index. Cranial science is also about the invention and production of different measuring instruments. As I showed you before, and I'll show you now again, Paul Broca's facial angle, being one of the more famous ones of the measuring instruments, in which a 90-degree angle is taken to indicate a perpendicular face, whereas a lesser angle indicated a face that from top to bottom sloped outwards and was said, in Cuvier's words, to have, quote, more animal traces. So for Cuvier, the facial angle, in being linked to cranial development, could be read as indicating a degree of humanness. And to be clear here then, where a lesser than 90 degree angle was taken as indicating, in his word, less liberation from animal sensory existence, and thus less, in his word, intelligence. And the closer to 90 degrees, the greater the liberation, and thus, in his words, the higher the intelligence. It's a hypothesis that crucially here, for me at least crucially, Cuvier stated was evident, to quote him, in European heads, where the angle is usually 80 degrees, in Mongols 75 degrees, and in Negroids 70 degrees. So if we just sort of step back a bit from that and look at, from my point of view about what's kind of happening here, we see that race is being used and it's being invoked to test, to prove even, the humanist thesis of absolute human distinction from animal. Just as speculation is starting to get aroused in the early 19th century that race and race deficiency might be fixed as innately given in the human body. Continuing here on the methods of cranial science, there were not only such instruments and measures of, as the facial angle, it also developed guidelines and protocols for ensuring the accuracy of results. And its forms of presentation were often comparative and tabular. If you take here, and you don't need to be able to see at the back, you'll be glad to know, a table here from Samuel Morton, writing about the types of mankind out of the United States. A table here showing the size of the brain in cubic inches of races and families of man. What you see here is a set of calculations of what was called the cephalic index, using the ratio, in this case, of the head width to the head length. And that was usually obtained by calculating the volume of peppercorns or lead shot that could be taken to fill skulls. Okay, in this book that I was talking about earlier, what was interesting for me in this book was to note how right at the limit, as it were, of the human was the Australian family. So in that sense of having a referential role then in the constitution of what it meant to be human. So these kinds of, going back to the method here of tabular forms of comparative presentation, to later on in the century, where am I here, what one finds here is an entirely new and fresh human-animal problematic. No longer then, like before, a problematic that had as its underpinning philosophy the chain of being from angels through to inert rocks and minerals and so on. So no longer a human-animal problematic informed by the chain of being, and instead a problematic of evolutionism steadily developing, which fetishised Morton's measure of cranial capacity. In other words, that fetishised brain size still further. We take, again, as was often indicament, a section of Australian skulls and a section of Tasmanian skulls from this later period of evolutionism, a period then in which brain size really starts to matter. To mappings, again, from this evolutionary period, to mappings, what we have here of the interior of the brain itself, interior of the brain itself, description of the cerebral hemispheres of an adult Australian male. And I think that it maybe is a convenient moment for me to just sort of step outside for a moment and just say just a tiny bit about the significance of a subject that some of you may have been wondering about, and that is of gender, and which I really do think would be a whole different story, as would be a study in craniometry's application to genius and to criminality, which certainly went on during this period as well. What I have come across is one interesting article by Elizabeth Fee about this period of craniometry in the late 19th century, which mostly attended and worked with male skulls, as these were presumed to be the benchmark against which all others were measured. With the infamous, she says, exception of Blumenbach's reference in the early 19th century to the beauty of a Georgian female skull. But to stay here with what I'm trying to do here with the point about the methods of cranial science, by the late 19th century and... Oops, no. Oh, dear. as is depicted in this particular image, what we have here is the practice of hemisphere diagramming, and so on. So you get some, hopefully, from that summary then of the different techniques and technologies of craniometry, that what we're trying to do then in this project is effectively to open up the head. And it does so not because after constructivism the head was merely an object for an idea of racial difference and hierarchy that it transported, but because the project wants to actually stay with and take seriously the entities, the events, the processes out of which craniology got to be achieved and got to be performed, and according to which not only, I'm trying to argue here, a biological idea of race got to be developed, but a materialist idea of human distinctiveness came to be formulated and reformulated. Now, as some of you probably know here, we're trying to work with some of these ideas around assemblage theory. I think it's fair to say that this is yet to fully gel in geography in terms of its theoretical coherence, in terms of its methodological specificity, in terms of its narrative strategy. But for me at least, it would appear to assist the reconceptualisation of race and the human that is at stake here, allowing too, as assemblage thought does, for the many failed efforts, and there were thousands of failed efforts of cranial science, to actually correlate brain size with the mental proficiency and deficiency of the world's people. So again, I think that the assemblage problematic is very useful then in getting at some of these fragilities and certainly some of the failures that went on in cranial science in this incredibly fraught and anxious effort to correlate the brain size of the world's people with mental proficiency and deficiency. Now, the assemblage problematic has, I think, and we notice, been increasingly criticised for not paying enough attention to power relations and structures that condition the assemblies of elements that are of interest to any particular project. Here I think it's actually unavoidable to take on board that the critique, this whole fetishised apparatus of calibrating head size and shape with a faculty of intelligence will only have been possible in the context of colonialism. It certainly didn't happen in the abstract. It happened then very much within the context of those power relations of colonialism, raising questions about human diversity and also in facilitating the very networks and all of the economies through which skulls got to be, of various races, got to be collected, got to be transported, preserved, and so on. Okay, then, so some concluding comments. So what my co-researcher Colin Perrin and I are trying to do in this project is to give detailed attention to the supposedly post-Christian and post-metaphysical terms and techniques in which the idea of human distinction was crafted in the 19th century, positioning itself then within, and I think at the same time also trying to augment some of the current, some of the recent currents in geography, in nature cultures research. And there I note that while one of the ethical concerns with the non-human and with the more than human is precisely to decenter the human and in so doing challenge the very idea of human exception, little attention has so far been paid to that idea beyond a vague general reference to its Christian Enlightenment and modern origins. There's a sense here that in its attention to the more than human, something of the human remains under-considered. Or, if this attention to the more than human is understood as a rethinking of the human in its whole kind of embeddedness in the world and its interrelationship with things, then clearly this amounts to a rethinking, not just of non-human beings, but also of human being itself. Of human being, then, not as some marker of something uncontroversial, but as itself, and as Sarah Watmore has written, the stuff of fabrication. I've been trying to argue that human exceptionalism shouldn't be understood, as Latour in Reassembling the Social and Law in After Method would warn, as an immaterial and so also an ahistorical idea. That, remaining essentially the same, lies behind ever so many and explains so many contemporary attitudes, concepts, methods, policies, institutions, and I think we see some of this in today's very shrill anti-humanist environmentalist rhetoric. The persistence of the idea of human distinction itself needs to be accounted for in its multiple, subtle, insidious and far-reaching, supposedly post-Christian and post-Enlightenment elaborations. To leave this idea under-interrogated is to risk, I think, missing much of what it is that needs to be decentered. What it does is restrict attention to the most classical formulations of human distinctiveness and rethinking the human only then in relation to their rejection and their reversal. So, for example, then in the name of the body, emotion, affect. So there's a critical self-interrogation, I would think, that's at stake here, that engages in a more thorough examination of human exceptionalism and its legacy. And here, insofar as it extends to an entire constellation, and I did say this project made me very nervous about the sort of fundamental issues at stake here, but it seems to me that it leads to a kind of rethinking of a whole constellation of terms around intelligence, civilization, progress, technology, that have to do not just with our relationship to non-human things, but with our relationship to ourselves and to other human beings. So if the innovation announced by Nature Culture Studies has provoked more of a rethinking of what was formerly known as nature, then a similar critical attention, I think, needs to be given to what was formerly known as culture. As for the idea of race, which is where I've come into the Nature Culture's intervention, so from a very different source, I would think, from those who come into it with more conventional environmental interests. As for the idea of race, I think the existing critique of it that I notice in geography has been largely a humanist one. And I'm still working through, I should say, the implications of this. But it's clear to me that, like earlier generations of liberal critiques of prejudice and discrimination, what this humanist critique within the self-other identity politics kind of problematic has served to do is to continue to lock and petrify race within a now very obdurate self-other paradigm of intersubjective human relations. And what I'm trying to provoke in this project then is a repositioning of race within a much wider framework of human nature relations. Specifically, an idea of human distinction. Specifically, as I've tried to track our way through in this talk, specifically, a very specific rendering of an idea of mind as a material intelligence that could be measured. And it's my sense that a 21st century audiences, as I said before, are, I think, willing to rethink. And indeed, perhaps they might be increasingly forced to rethink without wanting to get into too much alarmist talk about planetary limits. Certainly in the Australian context, there's been a tendency to lock the story of colonial race and racism in the narrative group of these inevitably antagonistic self-other identities, Indigenous versus settler. what I've been trying to do here is probably rather too ambitiously, but present, as it were, Australia with a new past. Because the account I'm trying to piece together here suggests that the history of Australian colonialism has as much to do with what we might call the history of an incomplete secularisation of the human. And here, if I'm to conclude with Latour, he states this: let us at last secularise the world, for whom it is precisely then secularisation that constitutes what for him is a new ecological ethic. And that's where I end.